The Early Years, 1827 to 1862, Volume 1, Chapter 28. 1860, Initial Steps in Church Organization. While Ellen White had written and published at some length on the need of order in managing the work of the church, see Early Writings, 97 to 104, and while James White had kept this need before the believers in addresses and review articles, the church was slow to move. What had been presented in general terms was well received, but when it came to translating this with something constructive, there was resistance and opposition. James White's brief articles in February aroused not a few from complacency, and now a great deal was being said. J. N. Loughborough, working with White in Michigan, was the first to respond. His words were in the affirmative, but on the defensive. Says one, if you organize so as to hold property by law, you will be a part of Babylon. No, I understand there is quite a difference between our being in a position that we can protect our property by law and using the law to protect and enforce our religious views. If it is wrong to protect church property, why is not wrong for individuals to hold any property legally? The Review and Herald, March 8, 1860. James White had closed his statement in the Review, laying the matter of the need of organization of the publishing interests before the church with the words, if any object to our suggestions, will they please write out a plan on which we as a people can act? Ibid, February 23, 1860. The first minister laboring out in the field to respond was Arthefk Cuttrell, a stalwart corresponding editor of the Review. His immediate reaction was decidedly negative. Brother White has asked the brethren to speak in relation to his proposition to secure the property of the church. I do not know precisely what measure he intends in this suggestion, but understand it is to get incorporated as a religious body according to law. For myself, I think it would be wrong to make us a name, since that lies at the foundation of Babylon. I do not think God would approve of it. Ibid, March 22, 1860. Cuttrell was experienced and influential. His message, published in James White's absence, set the pace for a long drawn-out battle. The matter seesawed back and forth through the next 6 months, with some reference to it in most of the issues of the Review. Then came the call for a general conference at Battle Creek opening Friday, September 28, to consider safeguarding the work through some type of organization. Because of the importance of the conference, its business proceedings are reported in great detail in the issues of the Review and Herald for October 9, 16, and 23. The business meetings began September 29 immediately after the Sabbath, with Joseph Bates called to serve as chairman. Having in mind the debate that had been running in the Review, those attending the conference moved immediately into a lengthy discussion. It was clear that most looked negatively on any steps toward organization. Meetings continued through the evening after the Sabbath and Sunday morning and afternoon, ending finally with the adoption of the following. We recommend to the conference the organization of a publishing association that may legally hold the Review office. Ibid, October 16, 1860. With relief, James White stood and said, this is just what I have been pleading for the last 6 months. Ibid, October 23, 1860. On Monday at sunrise, the conference met to adopt a constitution built upon this action. First, White made some remarks, expressing his gratitude for the candor and good feeling and unity and regard for the principles of right, manifested by those present. Ibid. The first of the 10 articles adopted that Monday morning read, this association shall be denominated the Advent Review Publishing Association, the object of which shall be the publication of periodicals, books, and tracts, calculated to convey instruction on Bible truth, especially the fulfillment of prophecy, the commandments of God, and the faith of Jesus. Ibid. The balance of the document was given over to details of organization and staffing and an outline of duties of various officers. But the business of the conference was not over. Adopting a denominational name, a brother Brackett stood to his feet and spoke. I now move that we adopt a name, as we must have a name if we are to organize so as to hold property legally. Ibid. Cautiously the conference moved into this highly sensitive area. Brother Poole feared that to adopt a general name would hurt them as a people. J. B. Frisby was opposed to a sectarian name but saw the need for some uniformity of the terms by which the body of Sabbath keepers would be known. Moses Hall thought that the churches in various places might be known as the church worshiping on the seventh day in such and such places. James White stated that he did not see how they could get along without some name, and they could not hold property without a name. The law was specific on that point. He could not see that this would be going into Babylon. M. E. Cornell was articulate in expressing his feelings. The commandments of God and the faith of Jesus is a distinguishing feature between us and the other denominations. It looks to me too that the gifts of the church are lost sight of and are not held in so important a light as they should be if we give way to so much fear of our becoming Babylon merely by adopting a name. There is confusion in the names already chosen, and if something is not done here, churches will go on choosing different names still. A general name will bring us into unity and not confusion. Ibid. T.J. Butler, speaking of the church, took the position that God, who had framed and devised this building, declared it to be the church of God, and he said, "If God has named us as parents have a right to name their children, does it not denote a lack of modesty to try to slip out and take no name, or another?" The discussion continued in earnest terms through the morning hours till 11 o'clock, when a recess seemed in order. The minutes of the discussion after lunch read, "The question again brought before the meeting, shall we adopt some name?" Some who had previously been averse to such a step here signified their change of opinion, and their readiness to cooperate with their brethren in this course. Ibid. Brother Sperry was willing to lay his prejudices on the altar, believing that God would give wisdom. Stephen Belden, employed in the review office, expressed his feeling that going without a name would be like publishing books without titles, or sending out a paper without a heading. James White then took the floor and apologized for some of the brethren who seemed to be afraid of a name. The review reported some of his comments. He had been in the same position once. In times past when we were comparatively few, he did not see the necessity of any such steps. But now large bodies of intelligent brethren are being raised up, and without some regulation of this kind will be thrown into confusion. He then gave a review of the past, mentioning the opposition which had been manifested by some all the way along, first against publishing a paper, then against issuing pamphlets, then against having an office, then against the sale of publications, then against church order, then against having a power press. It had been hard to bring the minds of some of the brethren to the necessity of these things, but they had all been essential to the prosperity of the cause. Ibid. The motion to adopt a name was finally put before the delegates, and it carried. The record states, none dissented, though a few declined to vote. Turning again to the minutes, we find the story of the outcome, which gave birth to the name by which the Sabbath-keeping Adventists would be known. Seventh-day Adventists, the name chosen having voted to adopt a name, the discussion now turned on what that name should be. The name Church of God was proposed and zealously advocated by some. It was objected that that name was already in use by some denominations, and on this account, was indefinite, besides having to the world an appearance of presumption. Brother White remarked that the name taken should be one which would be the least objectionable to the world at large. The name Seventh-day Adventists was proposed as a simple name and one expressive of our faith and position. After some further remarks, Brother Hewitt, the most honest man in town, when in 1852 Joseph Bates arrived in Battle Creek to herald the message, he went to the post office and asked for the name and address of the most honest man in town. He was readily directed to the home of David Hewitt. Bates felt that an honest man would readily accept the Advent message. After a day together in Bible study, David Hewitt accepted and became the first convert in Battle Creek, offered the following resolution. Resolved, that we take the name of Seventh-day Adventists, Ibid. This resolution was discussed freely, and the wording was adjusted to that we call ourselves Seventh-day Adventists. It was finally acted upon, Ibid. Even so, T.J. Butler, of Ohio, dissented, and Elders Lawrence, Sperry, Andrews, and Ingram refrained from voting. Now the Sabbath-keeping Adventists had a name that Ellen White was shown carried heaven's approval. It had been a momentous conference, clearly influenced by the Spirit of God. Led by God in the switch of travel plans, Ellen White's physical recovery after the birth of the fourth son on September 20, 1860, just before the conference, was slow. But it seemed she was well enough 3 weeks later to allow James to leave for Iowa and Wisconsin for a trip that had been planned and that would take him from home for nearly 7 weeks. It was at the conference in late September that plans were laid that eventually took James White on this trip. J. N. Loughborough was to make the trip west, visiting the churches, while James White was to travel to the east. But 3 days before the two ministers were to leave Battle Creek, James was greatly distressed in mind concerning the plans. Taking Cornell with him, he went to Loughborough's home to try to settle the matter. Unitedly they sought counsel of the Lord, and their minds were impressed with the need of switching the plans. Loughborough would go east and White west. Loughborough wrote of the experience. On the evening of October 6, Brother White in company with Elder Cornell came to my house and said, "I feel strangely in regard to our proposed trips. I do not feel free about going east. I do not know what it means." We all engaged in a season of prayer over the matter. As stated in Testimonies for the Church, 1:244, then the clouds parted, and the clear light shone. My husband, Elder White, felt that the Spirit of the Lord was directing him west and Brother Loughborough east. After this they felt clear as to their duty, and moved accordingly. We knew nothing as yet of the fanaticism that was developing in Wisconsin. How the Lord directed to check this fanaticism is thus expressed in Ibid. 1:228, 229, in Wisconsin there was a wrong to be corrected. The work of Satan was taking effect and would destroy souls if not rebuked. The Lord saw fit to choose one who had had experience with fanaticism in the past and had witnessed the working of Satan's power. Pacific Union Recorder, January 25, 1912. Loughborough later confessed that he did not know how he could have met the situation in Wisconsin, for he had had no experience in dealing with fanaticism. He commented, "We could now clearly see the providence of the Lord in leading to the change of the previous arrangements." Ibidi, February 8, 1912. The husband and father away from home. James left Battle Creek on Tuesday, October 9. From Chicago he got off a short note home. His word arrived at Chicago well and safe, coming on Thursday, was reassuring. Friday, Ellen got a letter off reporting that she was doing well, still staying in bed in the parlor, and thought she would for another week, for she was yet a cripple. She confided, "You may be assured I miss your little visits in my room, but the thought you are doing the will of God helps me to bear the loss of your company." Letter 10, 1860. She wrote some family news. "Our nameless little one grows finely. Weighed him last Wednesday. He then weighed 10 pounds and one quarter. He is well. Willie is reading to Sister Benedict. He has lessons every day and I can see he progresses fast. My hand trembles so, fear you cannot read it. In much love, your Ellen Ibid." She also wrote, "I shall expect a letter as often as once a week, and will write you if able, as often," and she urged, "Let not despondency weigh down your spirits and do not feel anxious about home." The letter she received a day or two later from James was posted at Eddyville, Iowa, on October 11. In it he declared, "I am well. The coat is good this cold morning. I think I shall improve wonderfully in spirits and health out here. Oh, for a closer walk with God. He is my hope and confidence. Tell dear Henry, Eddie, Edson, and Willie that I love them and pray for them. Hope Eddie will learn to be careful and good." On Monday, October 22, she wrote to James. He had been gone nearly 2 weeks. "Thought I would pen a few lines. My health is improving. The children are well and obedient. We shall keep help if we can get it for a few weeks. Help is scarce. The little nameless one is fat and rugged and very quiet. Has not had a cold yet." She picked the letter up 2 days later and finished it. "I must send this today. I am getting along as fast as can be expected. Have had no pullbacks yet. Come up very slowly. The baby is 5 weeks old tomorrow, a fat, hearty fellow. He takes so much nurse. I am very hungry most of the time, appetite good. The children are all well. We have just weighed the yet nameless one. He weighs 12 pounds and a half, good weight. The children are doing well, are quite steady, are not perfect. This we do not expect of children. It looks like a long, long time before you return home, but we know you will feel as anxious to get home as we are to have you. We pray for you, on your journey. Write me often. I am anxious to hear from you. Yours affectionately, Ellen." Letter 11, 1860. In one letter she reported that Mary Loughborough called to see her nearly every day. In his letter from Dayton, Iowa, written on October 22, James wrote that he still had a long journey, 5 weeks yet, and added, "I begin to want to see you very much. But I am well and free and am doing well, and if you continue to do well, I shall enjoy this tour." He closes his letter. "Be careful of your health. Do not want for anything that money will buy. Remember me affectionately to Henry, Edson, Willie, and without a name. Tell them that Father prays for them and loves them very much. Yours in love, James White, J.W. to E.G.W., October 22, 1860. Thursday, November 1, he was on the Mississippi riverboat War Eagle, en route to points in Wisconsin where, unbeknown to him, there was trouble. Thinking of home, he wrote, "My faith is strong in God, and feel satisfied that I am in the path of duty. I am happy to have you give so good a report of home, of our dear boys. I love my family and nothing but a sense of duty can separate me from them. If I am in the path of duty, my family will do best to have me here." J.W. to E.G.W., November 1, 1860. In a letter Ellen wrote to Lucinda Hall on Friday, November 2, she mentioned her continued weakness of going upstairs on her knees, of having a long cry now and then, and added, "It does me good." Jenny was helping with the baby, but could not do everything around the house and tend the baby too. As for the baby, she thought him to be as large as a child 3 months old. She urged Lucinda, "Send him a name." Letter 18, 1860. Sunday, November 4, James had just arrived at Mauston, Wisconsin, where the wife of one of the ministers, Elder Steward, claimed God was giving her visions. Just before he reached Mauston, the folk in Battle Creek had been alerted to the problems there by a letter from Mrs. Steward containing her visions, which she sent for publication in the Review. "As we read these communications," wrote Ellen White, "we felt distressed. We knew that they were not from the right source. She requested the church in Battle Creek to pray for James in this mission, and at home the family earnestly sought the Lord. Recounting the experience, she observed, "We had passed through so many such scenes in our early experience, and had suffered so much from these unruly, untamable spirits, that we have dreaded to be brought in contact with them." Spiritual Gifts, 2:294. On arriving at Mauston and staying in the Steward home, James wrote of the situation being a mess and expressed the fear that fanaticism was taking deep root. But he could not speak understandably till he could take in more of what was going on. He feared he would have to speak plainly before he left, and reported, "I found here a spirit of triumph over those not holy. They talk as though they were all, or nearly all, holy here. I have been calmly putting on the check, and it has put one on the lounge crying. Others are as quiet as mice." J.W. to E.G.W., November 4, 1860. In this letter he wrote of being exceedingly glad to get Henry's and Edson's letters. "Good boys. I shall soon be home with them. Kiss Willie and Nameless for me." In his letter written 2 days later, he exclaimed, "Oh, I do wish you and Bob were here. But in 3 long weeks I shall see you, Lord will. Take care of yourself and the children. Be careful of yourself. I hope to meet you, both enjoying health. Love to all." AJW to EGW, November 6, 1860. Little is known of the details of James's work in Mauston and Marquette. Writing from Janesville, Wisconsin, he stated, "When I hear that you are well, I shall be happy. My Mauston report will probably take off the hair, Marquette take the hide. Steward is no more with us, I think." The Steward family were reclaimed, and the daughter, Mary, became an efficient and highly prized proofreader and copy editor at the Review and Herald. Near the close of Ellen White's life, she was employed for several years to aid in producing books. "There is now great anxiety to see and hear you. The time has come. My health is better than when I left Battle Creek. I count the days when I shall see you and our dear children, only 12 more." J.W. to E.G.W., November 15, 1860. On Monday, November 19, James White wrote to Ellen, "I was extremely glad to hear from you, and am greatly relieved. Hope to hear from you again before I leave Monroe, so as to get the latest news." J.W. to E.G.W., November 19, 1860. He closed the letter with the words, "I do not ask you to weary yourself with long letters. Your care for me is great. May God help you and the children." The same day she wrote James, reporting, "We are as well as usual. Babe is fat and healthy, weighed last Thursday 15 pounds. He promises to be a very rugged boy. Babe is quiet and good nights, but I will tell you one thing, he is so hearty it will cost you quite a bill to keep me in him. He eats and throws it up and is just as greedy to eat again. My appetite is good. Food sets well." Letter 14, 1860. She closed her letter, "Dear husband, the time of your absence is nearly ended. 1 week more brings you home. We shall all be rejoiced to see you home again. All is well as usual in Battle Creek. As far as I know, Ibid." About this time James wrote from Macford, Wisconsin, "I fear that all is not well at home. I have had some impressions as to the babe." Spiritual Gifts, 2:295. While praying for the family at home, he had a presentiment that the child was very sick. The babe seemed lying before him with face and head dreadfully swollen. When Ellen received the letter 3 days later, she remarked that if her husband was there he would not have much faith in his presentiment. WCW, in the Review and Herald, March 5, 1936. But the next day the child was taken very sick with an extreme case of erysipelas in the face and head. A telegram was dispatched to James at Round Grove, Illinois. When he read it he declared that he was prepared for the news and that they would hear that the child's head and face were greatly affected. He cut short his trip, and in a day or two was home. In mid-November, Ellen had taken the children by train to the country and stayed with the Glover family. The boys, she reported in a letter to James written November 19, had a good, free time in the country. "I let them run and race as much as they pleased." It must have been in connection with this trip that the virulent germs of erysipelas, to which infants are very susceptible, were picked up. On Wednesday, November 21, she wrote a short note to James, "Dear husband, I put a letter in the post office yesterday for you and told you that we were all well, but Monday night our child has taken sick in the night and all day yesterday was very sick dangerous. Today not so much distressed, but he is not out of danger. He is a very sick child. I thought you ought to know this and then you could do as you pleased about returning. Sister Benedict was with me all day yesterday. Sat up with the child all night and is with me today. In haste. Ellen." Letter 15, 1860. The heartbreaking sequence was recounted by Ellen White when it was over. "My dear babe was a great sufferer. 24 days and nights we anxiously watched over him, using all the remedies we could for his recovery, and earnestly presenting his case to the Lord. At times I could not control my feelings as I witnessed his sufferings. Much of my time was spent in tears and humble supplication to God's spiritual gifts, 2:296. Although erysipelas is extremely contagious, and these were days before germs or viruses were known, neither Ellen nor any other member of the family was stricken. It must have been during this three-week period that the child was given a name, John Herbert White. Ellen White picks up the sad story. December 14th, Friday, I was called up. My babe was worse. I listened to his labored breathing and felt his pulseless wrist. I knew that he must die. That was an hour of anguish for me. The icy hand of death was already upon him. We watched his feeble, gasping breath until it ceased, and we felt thankful that his sufferings were ended. When my child was dying, I could not weep. I fainted at the funeral. My heart ached as though it would break, yet I could not shed a tear. We were disappointed in not having Brother Loughborough to conduct the funeral services, and my husband spoke upon the occasion to a crowded house. We followed our child to Oak Hill Cemetery, there to rest until the life-giver shall come and break the fetters of the tomb and call him forth immortal. After we returned from the funeral, my home seemed lonely. I felt reconciled to the will of God, yet despondency and gloom settled upon me. Ibid, the year 1860 had opened with James and Ellen White in the Loughborough home witnessing the death of their only child. The year closed with the vivid memories of the death of their own child, a babe of 3 months, casting a gloom that would not soon pass away. It had been a year with but little joy.